My name is Christian Beauclair. I'm a principal developer evangelist. What does that mean? It just means that I have more seniority over the others, I guess. It's a title. As developer evangelists, what we do is we go out and we talk to a lot of companies and a lot of developers. We talk to a lot of architects and managers. We visit colleges and universities across Canada. We talk to students. And then we talk to CIOs as well. So we have the advantage of going pretty much everywhere that there are people writing code somewhere. As an aside note, I'm also responsible for what we call independent software vendors, so our partners that write and develop application to make money on the platform, so the people who write the code that very often you will be using in your organization. Now today we're here to talk about the complexity of development. Over the years, things have evolved. Really, at the end of the day, the world is not anymore an easy world, right? It's changing very fast. It's changing in many, many aspects. It's changing all the time on what we write our software on, our code. Do we write it on a device, or do we write it on a server, or even this elusive new thing called the cloud? So we develop on many, many different platforms as we speak, and so it makes the complexity of development even more difficult over time. Now, there's a lot of words. This is what we call a tag cloud, no relationship, obviously, to the cloud. It's just a way of representing different words and their importance and what people see as their importance. You'll see that cloud and webs are very big. HTML5, phone, server, client. Those are things that people deal with on a daily basis. But then you can dig in and you can find very different words like email, telephone, collaboration, browser, linguistic. People have to deal in Canada very often with bilingualism, so having a French and English website. So these are all challenges, and that world is changing nonstop. Another big thing that's happening right now is more and more pressure on accessibility, having sites that are accessible. If you're in the public sector, it is a mandate. You have no choice. The sites have to be accessible for people with disabilities. And that means another challenge. You need to write your code thinking that somebody might not be able to speak or not be able to hear, or not be able to touch the screen, even. So it's great to have touch screen, it's great to have iPhones and iPads and all those things, but for a person who cannot reach out and touch those devices, it's more difficult. So they need to be able to talk to those devices very often, or use other devices to reach out. So again, a tremendous amount of challenges. So let's go back in time for a second, because I love this slide, because you know I've been in the industry for a fairly long time myself, over 25 years, and I've been part of this era in evolution, right? I joined the computer world, if you want, or the development world in 84. So in those days, it was pretty straightforward writing application, right? We didn't even have really client-server yet. We were still writing on teletypes. We were writing to these big things called mainframes, or minis, if you were not as lucky as the big enterprise to have a mainframe. So we had these smaller box, and they were called minis. They were still centrally located in a building, and then you access them with terminal. It was very easy to program for those things. How many of you were programmers or did deal with mainframes, minis, right? I mean, they were straightforward. You connected to it, you wrote your code on this one box, and everybody accessed your program from terminals, so they were just dumb terminals, and they connected to this program, and you ran it. Very often, it was done in Business Basic or COBOL, Fortran, those types of language, but they were very straightforward. So I did not have a lot of time in that era, because when I came in, really, in the heart of it was the launch of what the PC revolution, right? The PC started coming out. People started using the PCs themselves in the 80s, right, as just a device that had computing power, but they were not connected. They were not connected to somebody else's computer. They were not connected to the internet. They were just a computing platform itself. But then they evolved very quickly, and then suddenly somebody realized, why don't we connect them? And why don't we connect them to these new things that are cheaper? They're kind of like super PCs. We'll call them servers, and we'll connect the client, the PC, to that server. That way we don't have to worry about the mainframe and the mini. That's when really I spent a lot of time on developing applications that were client-server, that were using a database or some kind of networking protocol to connect to different devices. From a programming model, it was still pretty simple, right? We wrote forms. So we took what was user interface on the mainframe and we moved it to the desktop. And then we connected to a database. So in general, what was on the server was very straightforward. It was one connection to one server. You requested data. It gave you back the data, and you presented it in a form. So we wrote lots and lots and lots of forms. This is the era of Power Builder, Visual Basic, and many other tools, where the focus was simple. The other thing in those days also we didn't have to deal with was the user, right? The developers were the masters. They knew everything about computers. They were the wizards. And we made those forms, and we said, that's the way you're going to use the application. This is how it's going to look like, feel, and there was going to be some buttons on there, and you click on the buttons to execute a command. But we didn't think about the user experience in those days, right? We didn't really worry about that. It was just about productivity. It was just how do we turn those mainframe forms into client-server. Then the web started happening, right? This thing that allowed people all over the world to connect their PCs to this big web of servers and then start interacting in a new way. And HTML became the standard from a browser perspective. In a sense, we kind of went back a little bit because this was browsers, other than the new modern browsers, they were kind of dumb terminals themselves that connected to a server, got a page, and rendered a page. That was the extent of it. But it did bring something new. It brought the user experience in the mix. People started interacting with services that they did not have access before on their personal life and brought that back in the workforce and said, why are we not doing this the same way? So that brought a new change. But the other pressure point from a decision maker, from a developer manager that happened at that time was, oh my God, now the business wants to have a web presence. We still have to maintain all of that code that we have on the mainframe. We have to maintain all the code that we wrote in VB6 and Power Builder on those client server app. And now we have to do this web thing as well, because that is important. A business today in 2011 would not exist without a website presence. I know a lot of people now that will refuse to shop or deal with a business if they don't have even a website, because they're going to say, well, you're so old, we don't really need you. We want to go with the modern companies, the companies that have presence. Right? When banking came online, it didn't take a lot of time until the first bank went online for all the other banks to say, oh my God, we have to go online. And now look where we are. Probably, 80% of the time people deal with their finance online, not going into a bank anymore. So that made a big change. The new one that's happening right now, that new inflection point, is the cloud. Now we're going in saying, geez, great stuff. All these PCs are connected. They all have access to these servers in the cloud. So why are we still running those client server applications? Why are we keeping those servers inside the firewall? Why not take the data or the application itself and move it on the web? Well, moving it on the web is one thing, but it's even better if you can say, okay, I'm going to move this and not even have to worry about the server. Right? We're just going to move the application. It's going to run somewhere in a data center, somewhere in the world. It will be well protected, secure, and all that stuff. And then all I have to do is pay a monthly fee. I pay a bill every month, right? Operation instead of capital. This is the big driving factor right now, especially in the current economy, for going to this way. Now, other things are happening also from a developer's perspective. Obviously, a big shift and tremendous pressure points on how are we going to deal with all of those changes. But things are happening to the developers as well from a technology standpoint. The development is more complex today than it has ever been. When we dealt with a Mini, we wrote code line by line, and very often they had numbers in front of it, and the code executed pretty linearly. Now we live in a world where service-oriented architecture is the buzzword, right? You build your application in blocks, in Lego blocks, and then these pieces can be running inside a firewall, outside the firewall, on a local server, a hosted server, in the cloud. It could be running in another client PC. It makes it a lot more complex, these new patterns. We have to deal now with parallelism, right? Multi-threaded application, big thing now because we've reached the limit of what a processor can do. So now we're going to multi-core, and they're trying to cram as many cores inside a chip. Well, now we have to deal with the systems on chip era, right? The ability to say, why are we still making a motherboard with a processor, some memory, and a GPU or graphic processor unit? Why not put all of this into a chip itself so that we have only one chip to deal with? And then obviously the next step after that will be multi-core systems on chip. So as these things evolve constantly, the technology becomes more difficult for developers, and they have to deal with how are we going to do this. Dealing with cloud computing sounds pretty easy when I said you move the app from local to the cloud. But then that also means that you have to understand what the impact is, because that means you're now going to a sessionless state, right, or a stateless application. You don't want to maintain state in the cloud inside a piece of code. You want to move that state to multiple platforms so that you can scale. And so that's another challenge that's happening as well. Data, access to data. Probably a lot of you have been dealing with SQLite or SQL Server or Oracle or DB2 on the servers, which are a way of getting data from forms into this database. And we deal with stored procedure. Well, I personally challenge people and DBAs right now with the concept of stored procedure. I think stored procedures are becoming a dinosaur. They're going to disappear. Because stored procedure it was a way of scaling our database, making our database more efficient. But now with this distributed world, with this distributed platform, we can't have stored procedure anymore. Right? You're going to make requests. You want to go and put the data somewhere in the cloud. You want to scale to terabytes of data. Having stored procedure is kind of, it's defeating the purpose, right? It's bringing back this statefulness inside the database. So it's much better to have a piece of code that can go and retrieve data itself and have the logic in that piece of code, because then I can scale that much easier than scaling it from inside a database. So you'll see that happening as well. And now with the concept of open data, a lot of governments are opening their data. Obviously, Barack Obama, when he came in, one of the changes he made is he said, all of the public information that the government owns should be given freely to all the constituents, right? To everybody who lives in the United States, and actually they went the world, because even you can write application that takes advantage of that code. So he created data.gov. Something happened here. I lost the screen. There we go. Sorry about that. The Canadian government has just launched their own open data government initiative. So they have now open data catalogs, so data sets that people can go out and use in their applications. You see it also at the municipal level. Vancouver was one of the very first cities in Canada to adopt the open data standard. And Microsoft, working with a partner here in the local region, we did the VanGuide, which basically gave access to data sets that the government of the city of Vancouver had published, so that people can look at the map and see all the bus stops and the water fountains and the libraries and the fire departments and the schools. All that data was available, so it just take the data set, take a map, match the two together, and boom, you have a platform. And even that VanGuide's been open source, so that anybody can take it, any cities can take it and mimic the same type of systems, but just connect to their own data. But again, all of those things, geolocation, data, multiprocessor, parallelism, those are all things that make the development more complex. The business are expecting more. Every day you walk into a business, they'll probably tell you, oh my God, the CEO just got an iPad, and he wants to connect it to the network. And more people are seeing these devices that are in the consumer space, coming into the business space, that are expecting connectivity. So we are seeing this pressurization, if you want, of PC, phone, TV, whatever the device is, onto the business world so that they can get access to their information even when they're at home or on their own system. So through the cloud or on-premise, it doesn't really matter. We call this consumerization. Obviously, the expectation is more and more as people go out, they see all these devices, all this power, all these cool-looking apps, and they come back to the business and they see that form that I was talking about that was developed on VB6 that has just like form fields and an OK. So the experience that people have outside, on the outside world, has not been reflected inside the firewall. And that has started to cause a lot of pressure as well on people. So what we need is really a holistic approach to managing this complex, right? You need to be able to take the whole picture of all of this complexity, and the best way to order chaos is to put process in place. And it's the way, the approach that you need. You need to be able to look at requirements all the way to the development of business value. And I call this development of business value, by the way, on purpose. Okay, we're not just developing an application. If you're developing applications still today, you're probably doing the wrong thing. What the business wants, they want to see business value. They want to see something that's going to help their business, either outside or inside. And so as you build things, you should always think in business value. I'm building an application for business value purposes. It starts, obviously, with process. Process are how we order chaos, right? It also includes people, people that have to know how to build these applications, but also the people outside of the development team that have an impact, either the users, the end users of your application, or the stakeholder up front. And it also includes the tools, the tooling both from a developer perspective and the technology platform they're going to be using. And so today, this session is part of an ongoing conversation we've been starting, that we started 2 years ago, called Align IT with the IT professional on how to manage their portfolio of services. So we talked a lot about how do you make sure you look at your email as a service? How do you look at your security tools as a service? And how do you build this ITIL organization that knows which piece are what in your service? And you can do SLAs, and you can tie back business value, again, going back to what is the business value on email. You go into any organization, or very often I walked into an organization and said to the CIO or any of the managers, you know, what about email? Oh, email is just like one thing that we use. But then you ask them what happens when the email shuts down. And I mean, the company shuts down, right? Nobody can move. It's kind of like everybody freeze. They don't know what to do anymore because they can't send an email or they cannot access their data. So email is critical to an organization. Once they realize that, then there has to be a service level agreement. And those things are all a conversation that we started with the IT pro, but we realized this year that we have to do the same thing also from a development for the developer manager and the people involved in the development of application, customized application, or the buying of managed package inside an organization. And so this is what we're going to be talking about today. So let's shift gear and start looking at each of those three blocks, right? The technology, people, and process. And I'm going to start with technology. The reason why is obviously Microsoft's a technology company. It's my comfort zone. I know about technology. But we will be talking about people. We will be talking about process. And John, in the second session, is going to give you a whole bunch of example on how to use the tooling to support this initiative. And in the third session, we'll have a guest speaker who's going to come and talk about the real world use of those tools. So it starts with application. When you ask any users inside an organization or outside an organization, anybody thinks of it as an application, right? I bought this word processor application. I use Twitter. I go and I buy a financial system. It doesn't really matter. For the users of your systems, they all view it as an application. And those can be packaged. They can be custom developed application. They can be website. Right? To the developers, also what they're doing is developing these application and deploying these application inside the organization. So that's a pretty simple view. And by the way, I love this slide because I think this is the best cohesive view of the development process and everything that affects it. So this is the application, but underneath this, we all know as people involved in that development process that there's a stack, right? There's something, there's a platform that is running that application. And that without that platform, the application itself would not exist, right? You install an application on an operating system, or you browse to a web application through a browser. But there has to be a platform underneath that is running that application. that it's on the client or on the server, on the PC or on the server or on a phone or any type of device, this is what we have to deal with. So as developers, we deal with a middle tier, a database, and a platform or an infrastructure, right? Our infrastructure can be Active Directory. It can be an open type of APIs for directory. We have to deal with virtualization and security. There are plenty of things in the infrastructure. And then on the database layer, again, we deal with, geez, I wonder why it keeps switching like that. We'll have to make sure that we fix that between the two sessions. Let's see, am I at the correct slide? No. I was right here. So we deal with the infrastructure, the database, transaction processing, data warehousing, reporting, the same thing with the middle tier. Now you'll notice that there's another box that was added there, composite applications, because now we deal with this too, right? The database might not be our own database. I talk about open data. The database could be sitting somewhere else on the internet or into another data center. So we have the concept of taking pieces of applications that we have today and making new application or composite applications. They can be based on package app or custom app or web apps, but they also have other pieces that come from somewhere else. Then we have to make a decision. Are we going to run this stack, this big Lego block cube, are we going to run this on-premise or in the cloud? And by the way, this is not just a Microsoft-centric view, right? This is, doesn't matter which brand or which platform you use or if it's a hybrid of the dimension, right? It could be pieces of Microsoft, pieces of Oracle, pieces of IBM. It doesn't really matter. It's a block that we have to deal with. But we have also to deal where are we going to run this block? Because each Lego block does not sit necessarily inside one server. It could be on a different server. It could be on-premise or in the cloud as well. Now, when you stack on this the small, medium, large screen, and it's funny, we had a debate when we were creating these slides of going, you know, is it PC, phone, and slate, and TV, and server, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can come up with different ways to list this. We realized very quickly that it really has nothing to do with the device itself. It's either a small, a medium, or a large screen. And what we put in these categories, small would be like phone and slate and everything that's single purpose, very straightforward. The medium would be all of the PCs, laptop, desktops, and then the large screens would be the TVs or the wall display or these big devices that display more information. You know, it doesn't matter where you sit. What that means is that using any type of screen, you have access to this stack as well. Now, you lay down on top of that the ability to manage that stack. This is what we talk to IT pros normally about. It's that management tools of all of this stack. One of the critical pieces for us when it comes to developers on the Microsoft platform is that the same management tools are used across the board. So if you develop for any piece of that cube, if you're a developer on .NET, you can write basically a security module for the infrastructure, or you can write an application or workflow, or you can write a Windows Phone 7 app in Silverlight that runs on the small screen. But at the end of the day, this is all managed using the same tool set on the Microsoft System Centers, management tools. You can manage all of those tools. But more importantly for you today, what Microsoft has done is make sure that when we come to develop for this cube across the cloud or on-premise on any of those types of devices, and it changed back to PC, phone, and browser, I don't know why, we use the same ALM, application lifecycle management, and tools for the development process. Visual Studio is the tool set we use, right? You write the same security module that you want to write in C++ and Visual Studio, or you write your Windows Phone 7 app or your Xbox game even on Visual Studio and using the same tool. So it's the reason why we wanted to do this. It's to manage, to make sure that all of the pieces are managed in the same fashion. Now I want to specifically talk about cloud and traditional or within the firewall. Microsoft has a stack representing all of those layers, right? The infrastructure, database, middle tier, and application. You can see it on both sides. the beauty of it is that we did not create a different platform when we launched a cloud. We didn't say, okay, let's go and write a new types of server. We used Windows Server 2008 R2. So we moved it in the cloud, we virtualized it, we wrote a layer on top of it to do a platform as a service, but then you use the same development skill set across the board. Right? You use the same developer who's developing a Microsoft ASP.NET application on IIS on Windows Server using a SQL Server backend inside the firewall. That same developer writes the exact same app for the cloud, and it will run. They don't have to be retrained every time. And that is one of the key aspects of all of this complexity is, and this holistic approach, is that every time you introduce a change, a new technology, that means learning, that means training, that means bringing more people from outside the organization. Where if you make sure, if we keep to our word and we keep delivering like we've been doing for the past few years, that same stack approach, then that saves you the time. Because literally, you can take that developer who does a security module and have him or her develop a Windows Phone 7 app very quickly, because it's the same language, the same tooling. So let's look at the Enhanced experience in quickly more detail. So, you know, one development environment across from a rich to a reach. So that means from a Windows 7 full-on application all the way to a web-based with the reach of HTML5, for example. Across all devices, it's the same development environment. We have Silverlight to provide richness on multi-platforms. So Silverlight is our way of delivering the ability to write rich application experience, but on different platforms and cross-platforms, so Apple and the Microsoft platform, for example. We have the framework is the same framework for writing collaboration workflow services across the board. So again, very smooth transition between all of this. We support the same debugging tool set. A great example, and John's going to talk about that, is IntelliTrace. We introduced in Visual Studio 2010 a concept called IntelliTrace, which allows you to do historical debugging. So you can deploy your app without putting it in debug mode, but the app is tracking all the information, the call stack if you want, and the variables, and all that information in an historical debug session. And then once something happened, your developer can go back, open this historical debug, and walk line by line, literally, through the code after the fact. So it makes it very easy to debug operational or production application. Well, that same skill, that same tool set, is now available also for the cloud for Azure. So I can actually deploy a cloud-based solution that will capture all the IntelliTrace information. And then when something happens, I can go back and historically walk line by line and see the stacks and all the variables. And John will show that later. But it's really cool the fact that, again, it's the same tooling to do your testing, your debugging across no matter which devices and any places in the stack that you set there. Same thing from security. We try to use the same approach for security. When we introduce new approach on security like SOAP with security, or that you secure your connection to a WCF Windows Communication Framework entry point, we use the same thing. It doesn't matter what the device is. Again, single programming model makes it a lot easier for your developers to be proficient no matter what technology they use. And then the same thing is applicable from the deployment perspective. Again, we manage the tool the same way, but we use the same setup package, right? So you deploy an app, you write the code, and you create a debug a setup package. It's the same one that runs on the server, that runs on the client, that runs on the cloud. So it makes it, again, very, very easy for you to develop and deploy application pretty straightforward. I want to talk about three specific, tag cloud at the beginning had three specific things. I want to talk about those because they are, right now, very important for people. There are the key things that we see people asking about. The first one is from a cloud development process. I talked about Azure. Azure, it's the exact same skill set that your developers have today to write ASP.NET MVC or PHP or a Java application on Windows Server that they can use to do the same thing on Azure in the cloud. As a matter of fact, I talked to a company who's developed a full-on client web-based interface using ASP.NET MVC with a SQL backend, and they have the application production, all of that. I said it would take you about a day to move this to a cloud. And the reason why I say a day is probably just for the time that it takes to upload the app and then wait for it to spin up. But once it's up and running, it's really quick. But you just have that transition piece that's probably the longest part. Because taking an ASP.NET project and moving it to the cloud is just adding a project file, an Azure project file, pointing it to it. And what it does is it packages your ASP.NET site into a zip file, uploads that zip file, and installs it and manages the installation on the IIS, the configuration of the IIS server inside the Azure data center, and then spins up an instance, a virtual instance of your app. So it's very, very easy to do. And I do encourage you on your table, you should have all a little card. It looks like a business card with Azure. This is an Azure testing session, if you want. You have 30 days. You don't have to put a credit card. You can just enter that code. It will provision you with an instance where you can try this. You can have your developer take an application inside your organization or write one just for the testing purposes. And we do have great lab material and great training. If you have questions on it, Jonathan wrote an 8-part blog series on how to take an app, a sample app, and moving it into the cloud, and it explains all of the steps. It looks long, but it's not because it's long. It's just wanted to make sure that people got the steps. But I do encourage you to take advantage of that offer. It's 30 days. Again, no, there's nothing. You don't even have to record your real name if you don't want to. It doesn't matter. All it's going to do is at the end of 30 days, it's going to shut down the instance and take it away. So whatever you put in there will disappear in 30 days like it never existed. Go and try it and see for yourself that I'm not blowing steam right now, that I'm just actually telling you the truth. It is that easy to do. Another platform is the Windows Mobile platform, right? Phone development is the hottest topic right now. The iPhone, Android, Microsoft, the deal with Nokia, BlackBerry, all of those things are having an impact on business today. I just saw yesterday an announcement that Pizza Pizza has just launched an iPhone app that you can basically go and just click order a pizza and will know where you are. It will do the transaction for you and somebody will show up at the door with a pizza. You don't even have to worry anymore about entering your credit card information or finding out which is the closest Pizza Pizza. They'll deal with that. This is the advent of the microtransaction on mobile platform. This is the next big revolution. This will be the biggest thing. We were talking, you can come up with scenarios nonstop. Imagine walking to a museum. You walk in, you look, oh, this looks like a cool place. I want to visit it. You go into the app, you click, I want an admission. You walk to the person at the gate, and they just scan your badge, and you go in. Right? We do that with airplane now. We can do our check-in online before and now show up with just an electronic boarding card. So why not do the same thing when you purchase or when you go see a movie, et cetera, et cetera. We wanted, when we launched our platform, we didn't want to force you to go back to an archaic language like C. I'll be honest. I just thought that was an interesting idea to force people to write application in Objective-C for the iPhone instead of even going C++, which is more of a modern version of C. It's kind of bizarre in that way. But when we did our platform, we said, how can we do this so that the developers, again, don't have an impact? And Silverlight was already out there. C# and VB were already our languages. A developer who knows those three things, or even WPF, can write apps for the Windows Phone 7 and be productive within minutes. Not hours, not days. They don't have to go back and dust off an old book. They can do this right now, very, very quickly. I have a gentleman in Ottawa that is, I think he's about 70 years old. He's retired. He's been doing development almost all his career. He's been a professor also. He taught classes before. And he thought himself Silverlight when it came out, Silverlight 1.0, and wrote some Silverlight application for the web. So when the Windows Phone 7 came out, he said, well, you know, it'd be cool if I can manage my medication with it. And so he wrote an app for Windows Phone 7. You know, it didn't take him a long time. He had the app running, and very quickly it's in the marketplace now. So it's very, very cool to see that people who are familiar with the language can do these types of development very quickly. The last one I want to talk about, because it is hot topic right now, is HTML5. a lot is running, a lot is writing on HTML5 right now, right? A lot of people are expecting this to be the answer to all of our problems in the past. Now, I might be a little cynical, and I've been maybe in the industry a little bit too long when I hear that, but the reality is that I've talked to a gentleman called Paul Cotton. His name is Paul Cotton. He used to be at IBM, joined Microsoft about, I would say, about 8-9 years ago, and he's been involved with the W3C and the standards body a lot. And he does great presentation on standards, a great presentation on HTML. He's actually a sitting chair on some of the standards in the HTML5. The thing that is interesting is when you go and dig deeper into this, you'll find out that it's not that clear where we are now, right? I mean, we know where we are because there are some standards that are published and at recommendation level. But about 50% of it is not even there. So yes, HTML5 is the next big thing. It is absolutely fantastic when you look at what it will offer, but when it's there. In the meantime, you as developers and as manager have to deal with the fact that now this revolution is starting and the browser is starting, right? Microsoft shipped IE9 a few weeks ago. It's all HTML5, CSS3, SV, ECMAScript 5, geolocation aware, all of that stuff that are the standards that are the most stable or recommendation level, but we did not implement all the standards in it. And we got rave reviews so far for IE9, and we are willing to defend the fact that we did not implement all of the HTML5 current state standards, which the other browser are doing, because we have to deal with the corporate space. Our browser is one of the most used corporate based browsers out there, and certainly having a release every month would not go very well with the CIOs of those enterprises. Yes, on the consumer side, it's pretty easy. You just visit a site and you download a new copy of it, and you know, from an end user, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have an impact. But from a business, it does have an impact, and people want control. So seeing that you can implement as many of the HTML5 standards as quickly did not make sense. So what we did is we took a different approach. We are now releasing early prototypes as add-ons to IE9, so you can take a look at WebSocket, IndexedDB, and a whole bunch of other HTML5 standards inside IE9. So we're trying to bridge both sides. We have a stable IE9 that will do HTML5 and everything that's recommendation level, but we also allow people to develop on the newest stuff to play with as well. That, what is the impact from a tooling? Well, we released Service Pack 1, I don't know if you're aware, for Visual Studio, again, a couple weeks ago. In that Service Pack 1, for example, we've already implemented IntelliSense for HTML5. So when you do your HTML coding manually, it will do auto-completion of all the new tag names, as an example. Now, we don't have an editor, a fancy-looking editor yet, but we're working on that as well. For future versions, obviously, things are released at a faster speed. So now technology moves fast, but when you look at technology, that's one piece. We still have to deal with people and process, and how do we deal with this? We deal with this with tools. I want to show you the application lifecycle. One of the things I find the most important piece out of that diagram is that retire keyword. A lot of business people don't realize this. When they come to the next version, they don't ask their development group to go back and reassess the business value of that application, and did they deliver on the business success, and should we continue on, or should we retire that app? That's the reason why very often I see portfolio of apps inside organization that are very long, in the hundreds of applications. That's because they don't take the time to reassess should that app be retired instead of being upgraded or brought to the next version. So this is a very important cycle, but the most important piece is looking at a common skill set, right? Talk about people. People, and I've talked about this when I showed you on the technology side, when it comes to people and common skill set, this idea that a developer can write to any of those screens, to any of those technology, with that one skill set is very critical for us. We believe that with that, you can achieve much more, and that being on the cloud or not, right? That common skill set on any of those two platforms will lead to a big success. You will be able to move into new market much quicker. Right? People who had that skill set and decided to move into the Windows Mobile 7 or the Windows Phone 7 platform can do it very quickly and have an app very quickly out there. People who want to do HTML5 and make sure that the browser supports it with IE9 can do that now. People who want to write application in the cloud can do that now on Azure with that same skill set. Right? It opens up a whole set of new opportunities and new things that you want to do from an organization standpoint. And that's because we equip the people with that same tool set, that same technology across the board. But this would not work. Your people and your technology would not work without process. I talked about ordering chaos. Processes are created, were created a long time ago to organize chaos. Once you have a process in place, that way you can control it. You can know the state of your current development cycle. But process is more than just the development process. You probably heard the term SDLC, software development lifecycle, where you write an application, right? So you have the people developing, the people testing, the people QAing, and it's like that little clique of people together working. But the reality is it doesn't start there. It starts with the end user. It starts with the business stakeholder. And it ends with business value. It ends with your IT pros, your infrastructure folks who manage that infrastructure for you. They have to tell you, are you successfully delivering business value? And so it is when we say application lifecycle management, we say application lifecycle management is greater than SDLC. It includes the development process, but it's greater because it is from inception idea to delivery across the board. Process will bridge the gap between people. Once you have a process in place, it makes it a common language. When you go talk to your stakeholder or your users, and again, all the way to your IT pros, you have a common language with process. Process will also enable you to make more money or derive more value from your apps. Because you'll be able to say, if I know that this app was done for this purpose, to save the company X amount of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars, and then we go back and we measure the success and we say, you know what, we've achieved 2 times those millions of dollars of saving. When you go back to the CEO of the organization, the president, or the people involved, and you say, look how much we save, they're going to say, here's more cash, go do the next thing. Right? They're not going to say, oh my God, justify why we should give you more money in your budget, and you're a black hole, we just keep throwing more money at IT, we don't know what comes out on the other side. So process will enable this. It will enable a better communication and collaboration between the different stakeholders in the development process, but it will lead to a higher whatever, higher profit margin if you're in the private sector, higher savings if you're in the public sector, and then there's probably not really a lot of other types of percentage, but there may be, so think about that way. And then at the end of the day, a process will help drive a successful delivery. Right? If your process is clear on how to do it, you will end up with something good. A good example of that is architecture, right? Or building houses. This is probably one of the oldest processes that exists, but today it's a known process. It's pretty simple, right? It starts very early. You go see a contractor, and then they'll walk through a list of things that they know how to follow that will mean that from the time you have an idea of buying a house on a lot to the day you're going to walk in and get your key, this is what you're going to get. The same process should be available for the development lifecycle. So we want to ensure that the right thing is done, and I have no idea why that slide just went wrong, but it's ensure that the right thing is done right in the right way. Right? Ensure that the right thing is done right in the right way. It means process, people, and tools. Right? Those three rights, that's what it is. On that, I'd like to open it up for questions. We have about 2 minutes before the break. So we will have a lot of times today for a question as well for the other session. And the last one is very interactive as well. So any questions? Or was that all clear like mud? Yes. The does Azure scale with usage, and what is the cost involved? So without going into very gory detail, the cost is very much by instances and bandwidth usage. Those are the two main value. There's also the storage. But if we think about that, the beauty of the cloud, and Azure specifically, but any cloud offering today, is what we call elastic computing. That means that if you are chapters, let's say, and you have your site online, and you have three instances of your server dealing with the summer intake, and then we get to Christmas time, you can go in there and you can say, okay, give me 10 instances, just like that. Your bill the next month will be for 10 instances. Then after that, you can say, okay, shut down three of those, or four or five, and so you can go with the flow, and that's the reason why it's great, because it becomes operational expenditure instead of capital expenditure. Because if you buy 10 servers, even if you turn down three or seven, all you're saving is electricity, but you still have to pay the cost of those servers and the equipment behind it. And you have to pay the people to manage and to patch this and all that stuff. In the cloud, it's the beauty of elasticity. It's to say, I can go in and say, give me more instance. And every time you have more instance, it will cost you more. So your bill that month will be higher, but the month after, when you drop it down, it will go down. So it's elastic that way. If you go to the website, there's calculators for doing calculation to look at potential costs. Obviously, there's packages, and so that's the reason I don't want to go into specific pricing. Yes? So the question is about traffic going inside the data center, basically, of Amazon during high traffic period where you're trying to spin up instances and after when it's not, it's less used. Now, I don't want to compare Azure to Amazon, and I'll tell you why. Amazon is offering what's called infrastructure as a service. You spin up basically a virtual instance. You decide on the OS, but you manage the OS. So you have to configure your OS, your IP stack, your web server, your patching, all that stuff. You manage a server. All it is, the difference is that instead of being physically located inside, you manage it inside the cloud. Azure is platform as a service. You probably heard this term. Platform as a service means that instead of having to deal with the bottom, all we are dealing with is the application layer. You deal with the application layer, you deploy your app, we manage the server, we patch it, we take care of all the IP configuration. We do these in containers. Microsoft's been in the cloud and doing cloud solution for a long time, right? I mean, since we bought Hotmail, we've been managing data centers, and even you can go back, since we've launched MSN in 1995, yes, 1995, when we launched MSN, we have built and managed huge data centers worldwide. So we do have the skill set and the way of doing this. When we build the Azure platform, we made sure that it was scalable. Spinning up instances is almost instantaneous. They're all built in data centers that have huge bandwidth in and out. I have not heard, and I cannot speak to your application or to specific application, I have not heard of that yet. We're still a year and a half into the product. So obviously we don't have the scale that Amazon has in number of instances. So that might be part of it, too. Another thing I want to do add is that Microsoft, when we build Azure, we build it for commercial purposes, not, and if you remember the history of Amazon, again, not a knock, but Amazon was created initially as, oh, we have all of this computing power that we don't use at downtime in our bookstores. Why don't we start selling access to it? But it was never built as a commercial initially. It became that, and it's very successful, but it was not built that way. We build ours as a commercial for commercial availability up front. So we do have SLAs with penalties where we will reimburse if your app is down, for example. So it's a different level in that sense. Yes? Okay, denial of service. So how do we prevent denial of service attack or? Uh, Oh, okay. So how do, yeah, that's a good question. How do you prevent applications from connecting to your server and drive more requests, basically driving your bill? Because we do charge for bandwidth in and out. So that was one of the value, right? So the instances and the usage of bandwidth. So if you have a rogue application that just connects, that is a bit of your responsibility in a sense. It's how you build your application. In general, what we see in Azure application is people are building like websites, right? So the same way people can drive demand on a website inside your firewall, you would have to apply the same logic. So do you have a way of protecting, if you want, from that type of attack? I am not aware of specific patterns, but I can find out if you want to give me your card or... Not to my knowledge. So the question is, was there anything that happened where people are wondering about that, and I've not come across that yet. No question online? Okay, so on that, these guys, by the way, it's not that there are no questions online. I know that these guys are answering the questions online as well, so if it's a generic or a general question, we would bring it up. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. Is that correct, 10 minutes? So we're going to start again at... Well, actually, late now, so I've taken time in the break. So what time? 5 minutes? Okay, let's start at 11 on the nose. 10 on the nose, sorry. Thank you.